Welcome to the Beekeeper's Corner Podcast.
December 7th, 2015, episode number 86, Recap on Tap. Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Beekeeper's Corner Podcast. My name is Kevin England. I think I mentioned that I was going to spend a touch of time away as I had a business trip to one of our manufacturing plants in Puerto Rico over the past couple of weeks. Also, Thanksgiving was in there and the end of the soccer season and other things going on as usual. Life just keeps marching on, but it doesn't stop me from keeping an eye to the wind to see whether or not there's any interesting beekeeping stories, news, notes, things like that to bring along. Plus, I always have a cache of stories or articles, research stuff that I want to bring in. And this episode is no different. So let me tell you what I have in store for this run. What exactly is housal positioning? I'll talk about that. Queens are made from what? A new story on queen rearing. Varroa mimicking bees, the follow-up to a question raised not too long ago. A source for an infographic on how the bees convert nectar to honey. We'll talk about another way to count varroa via anesthetizing. Is that how you say that word? Bees. I'll explain when I get there. Flow hive, what's old is new. We'll talk about gardener apiaries. Saving the corners of your woodenware, broodminder on order, and we'll end out the episode with a couple odds and ends, winter meeting recap, spring meeting on tap. But first, and as usual, we'll start with the local hive report. The bees are all nestled in their colonies with care, conjuring visions of pollen all caught up in their hair. The queen in her court and I in the house just settled down to record this winter podcast. Yeah, there's not much to report on in the local hive report, so I got a little creative there. Maybe I've jumped the shark. My hive out in the yard is quiet and it gave me a little surprise this week. I took the compost out the other day, and when I pitched it in the pit, I observed a host of bees in there, presumably feeding on something, probably looking for moisture and sugar. Now, there's only a mix of vegetables and such in there, but they looked pretty happy to have something to work on. And it shows you how desperate and how resourceful they will be this time of year. I was over the farm yesterday to check on my other hives, and I looked at the package hive started earlier this year. I realized that I had a feeder on it and I forgot it and left it on there. It's been on there since early November. So I pulled the feeder off, gave them a little bit of smoke, and there were a handful of bees in the upper box milling around, but no one was too concerned of my presence. Didn't even see a bee leap off the frames or anything. I quickly popped the feeder off, put the inner cover on, and closed up shop. The hive still feels heavy, which is the good news, and I didn't want to waste any heat, even though popping the top off probably accomplished that in spades. At least I got them closed up quickly. I didn't peek in on the polystyrene hive while I was there. Nothing to see. It was a little cooler in the afternoon, about 45, 47 degrees, if I remember correctly, and there was nothing flying. The primary reason to stop in the farm was because the single deep with only a handful of bees, as reported from the previous episode, was still out there. I was hoping to tuck that in before I left for Puerto Rico, but didn't get it through. So, you know, my original plan was to put them between the hives up at the mentoring yard, but as Bob and I spoke about in a recent episode, that fell apart. So to plan B, this weekend I was able to secure a 3-frame observation hive from the association, and I have them now stashed in the house. I'm not sure where their final resting place will be in the house. They're in the living room sitting on the wood stove right now, but I'm excited nonetheless that the prospect of being able to observe the colony over the winter and hope that I can nurse it through. Soon, they'll be all nestled snug in their beds in the comfort of the house. I'm really hoping, but I have no practical experience, that being in a warmer house will allow them to be productive and I could feed them. What I noticed is that they did have a couple frames of honey, two, not full, but enough, and some uncapped nectar. And the good news is I even saw some pollen in one of the frames that I pulled. I was sure to pull the queen. I would say the size of the cluster is about the size of a grapefruit to a baseball, maybe a little bit towards the grapefruit size. So I'm hoping I can get that queen laying. There doesn't appear to be any brood in there at this point. She seemed to be shut down, but get her in the house, feed her up a little bit, see if we can get her going. I also harbored some thoughts about purchasing some foam insulation this week, but didn't get the time. I wanted to give two of my regular Langstroth hives a little John Gott treatment. That's homage to the episode 72 where we spoke to beekeeper John Gott on insulating hives. I think it's still appropriate to consider his notions. And if you haven't heard that episode, I highly recommend you give it a listen. While we're going into winter, it's still somewhat warm here and has not been bitter cold, even though we're into December. John certainly had some pretty compelling things to say, and why I am still thinking about the insulation route, even though I'm a little behind the curve. It's segment number one of that episode and starts at the 8 minute and 49 second mark if you want to jump right to it. So that's it. It wraps up the local hive report, and hopefully by next weekend I can wrap up my hives and call it a day for the winter. It's time to head into the features of this episode, but first let me share some contact information. Care to write me about something, suggest a topic, or just say hey? My email is kevin@bkcorner.org. All of the shows are documented on our website, bkcorner.org. There you'll find notes to every episode, links, and the times when each topic was covered, as I just mentioned about the one for John. I also manage a YouTube channel for our association, youtube.com/NWNJBA, and I'll have some more to say on that later in the episode. So enough of that, let's head into our first feature. For segment number one, I want to talk about housal positioning. I've been meaning to cover this topic for a while now. At one point, I was looking up something about small cell beekeeping and looked around for information on that topic. While looking, I read a post from Beverly Bees, a blog that I frequent on occasion, and she was writing about a visit to Dee Lusby, a person who is well known for being a proponent of small cell bees. So given small cell is not the topic, let me get to the point. I merely wanted to say that in that article, or that blog post, Beverly had a mention about how Dee arranges her hives and housal positioning, and I always had a footnote to come back and learn what that is. Housal positioning is a technique of placement, I've discovered, of honeycomb, which is attributed to Michael Housal of Orlando, Florida. I tried to find something directly on Michael to see if he wrote about it, but I struck out on that. I only know of Michael from a BeeSource forum article from Dee Lusby proper, who happens to mention him in her piece on her inspiration for setting her hives up for housal positioning. There are some additional attributes to him on the web, more noticeably in the BeeSource forum itself. It's probably predicated on that article that I referenced from Dee Lusby on her management practices, but nothing seems directly discoverable from him on the web as far as I can see. I'll provide a link to this article, the Dee Lusby one that I speak of, and we'll reference it in this segment. Housel positioning, what is it? This is going to prove challenging to explain it verbally, but I'll give it a go. What would make the conversation more simple to follow is if you had a piece of beeswax foundation in your hand, but either way, let me see if I could do this justice. So beeswax foundation is made by melting wax and running it through a machine or a press that imprints the expected hexagonal shapes on each side. What you may never have realized is the detail in the design. It is always there in front of you, but so minute that it doesn't register. On one side, you have the familiar honeycomb pattern embossed, and on the other side, the raised edges create the same embossment, but one is ajar from the other, and you might describe it as an overlap. To make sure you're following me, let me state the opposite of what it is not. It is not the same hexagonal shape matched over each other perfectly on both sides where they share a common floor. One side is askew from the other, and the overlap. And they overlap is what I mean to say. And when looking through opaque wax, it creates a pattern, one you could see through the floor of each of the embossed cells, where you could see the lines from the other side through the bottom. So if I were to draw, let me pull away from that. If I were to draw the lines of a cell, I would start at the point at the top. I would draw down to the left. I would draw a straight up and down line to the bottom. Then I would draw to the right, to the bottom of the point, up and to the right, a straight line up, and up and to the left to make my hexagonal shape. Now, if I take two of those cells and I put them along each other, that straight up and down, they share a common wall. So if you're following me, they share a common wall. Let's talk about that line itself. At the top of that line, there's a line that goes up and to the right and up and to the left. That shape is a Y. At the bottom of that line, forget the Y part, just the line itself, there's one that goes down and to the right and down and to the left. That's a Y, but it's upside down. It's a line down and a V shape at the bottom connected. An up Y and a down Y. I'll explain why I'm calling this out in a second here. So in the opening of this, I talked about how when they imprint foundation, they overlap the cells. There's no flat common floor. Well, if you look through one cell into the other side, what you're going to see is an up Y or a down Y pattern from the other side that's through there. You following me on that? I hope so. So on the foundation part, you have the raised edges embossed with a flat floor. And if you look through the floor to the other side, you can see the raised embedded on the other side. But the floor itself is flat. Now let me bake your noodle. What you see on the floor is not that important, but leads to another discovery. If you look at built-out comb, not just the foundation sheet, but comb that the bees have built out for you, you would think that they would just extend the walls of the comb wax that is provided to them by the embossing. Au contraire. They actually build the cell up matching the lines from the opposite side of the face that you can see when you're looking through the floor. What you end up with as a result, is a raised up Y pattern or a down Y pattern in the bottom of the cell when the bees are done from the embossing on the side where they built the comb. These are made of the raised lines from the imprint on the foundation. The floor of the cell that the bees built isn't flat, but it has lines in the bottom. I didn't believe this at first. I had to go out and pull comb out of some of my extra comb and look in there. Isn't that interesting? That's pretty cool. So with that notion, now I can explain Housel positioning. And let me get straight to the point, and then we can explore it a little bit further. The hypothesis is this. When bees swarm and build out their first comb in nature, it is said that they build the first comb in the nest. And then, of course, they're going to build a second comb and a third comb alongside of that. But they deliberately place the Y positions in a specific way at the bottom of the cell. Since honeycomb foundation was made to emulate the true comb patterns of nature, wouldn't you place your honeycomb with its patterns built on foundation in the same orientation as you would if you were building a hive? Interesting. Do it just the way the bees would do it. So how would the bees do it? According to what Dee passed on from Michael Housel, if I have this all right, I hope I got it right. I studied it enough to think I got it right. The first honeycomb built by feral bees has the Y upside down on both sides of the comb. This is a special comb and the only one made like this in a feral hive. Now we, using foundation, cannot recreate this as our foundation doesn't emulate this. Remember, one side has an up Y and the other side has a down Y. There is a way, however, to emulate this as closely as possible to nature and set up your hive with Housel positioning. So the down Y is ideal for brood rearing, and you would want brood on the inner facing side of a hive. Without pretending to understand this, the notion is said that bees rearing worker brood would have optimal cells on the side that has the down Y in the bottom of the cell. The easiest way to help you follow me on the placement strategy is by using the inside of a hive as a reference and referring to the outermost frames in the box. I'm talking about a 10-frame Langstroth hive and frames in position 1 or position 10. That frame, 1 or 10, like all the others, should have the up Y face of the foundation against the wooden wall of the hive box. And so that direction of the hive is true for frames 1 or 10, which means the frames are flipped in the hive with the Y side facing outside for position 1 to 5 and in the opposite direction for 6 through 10. Doing this ensures that every frame has the side that faces the center of the hive in the down Y configuration, which is better for building bees. So going back to the reference article from Dee that I found on Bee Source, she shared that she's changed at that time, which was 2002, 35,000 frames in her commercial hives to follow this notion. Is it worth it? She thinks it is. In that article, she listed a number of problems beekeepers experience and attributes those problems to possible problems with Housel positioning of frames. I'll give you three, for example. Number one, if you don't have your positions correct, queens won't lay on drawn comb that's placed in the brood chamber. If you as a beekeeper come back days later and find the queen will not lay in the frame, it could be because you placed it with the upward Y towards the center. Problem number two that you might experience. If they build burr comb or hardly touch a frame, what can you do? Well, perhaps it was backwards to the relative pattern of where the downward Y faces the center of the hive. Problem number three, bees refusing to move up in the next higher box. Yep, she says that could be a reluctance to expand into the next higher box or super because the positioning is opposite of what it should be. So you get the gist of this. In that article, she shared 7 points. I shared 3. But it gets you to thinking, doesn't it? Now, let me provide a counterpoint to this before everyone goes off and declares this a salvation to the problems of the world. There are a number of known, well-known beekeeper advocates that are unabashed in saying this is snake oil and an interesting fabricated discovery, which a lot of beekeepers can talk about and has no merit. And I have to remind everybody that if you look in a hive, typically you will see brood on one side and brood on the other side, and three or four frames in a row. And when that hive is banging, that queen's going to build it right in the center of the brood chamber, up wire, down wire, whatever the case may be. I have to admit, of the seven problems, I've had all of them that Dee pointed out in her 7 points, but I'm far from thinking this discovery was the problem all along, especially since prior to this, I knew nothing about it. My practical experience in bee sense tells me that there's much more to consider for many of the problems that I experienced, and she points out. However, do I want to index my frames and give it a try? I must admit, I'm really intrigued. And except for some additional fussiness, what do I have to lose? I'm not a commercial person handling hundreds upon hundreds of hives and thousands upon thousands of frames. I'm a hobbyist with no more than 20 hives in my yard. So let me tell you what Dee does practically, so you could try this out if you wish. On the top of every frame, she puts the foundation in. She notes which side is the up Y side and which side is the down Y side. She orients the frame in front of her, and with a marker, she draws a right-facing arrow in the shape of a V sideways to the upside. And when you look into her hive from the front, every one of the frames has one of those indicators pointing to the left or to the right from the center of the hive. Now, obviously, from the center to the right, they're all pointing to the right, and from the center to the left, they're all pointing to the left. And she has all the down Y's facing in and all the Y sides facing out, just like I described earlier. So for me, I think for giggles, going forward, anytime I build a new hive with foundation, I'm going to try this and see how it goes. Perhaps the zen we've been looking for all along is why we should do this. Why we should do this. Get it? That was a double entendre. Never mind. I'm in one of those moods, folks. So look for a link to Dee's write-up and the Beverly Bee blog post in the show notes that brought me to the origin of this, and thanks to both of them for taking the time to document and share this notion with us. Segment number two is not so fast. Wired magazine recently ran a feature that points to a research study published in the August issue of Science Advances that concludes, contrary to what we knew to be true all along, queens are not queens because they are fed more royal jelly than a worker bee. Actually, that's not the determining factor. It is, in fact, based on their conclusion, backwards, and that queens are actually queens and not worker bees based on what they are not fed, more specifically, pollen and honey. It has always been said that queens develop the proper anatomy to deliver eggs, unlike worker bees, because their ovaries develop from being fed royal jelly. The researchers were working on a different hypothesis when they made this discovery through a serendipitous path. It is known that certain immunities of bees come from the plant materials that they consume. A study was being conducted to find out what happens when bees are fed an altered diet, and specifically they were targeting a compound called P-cumaric acid. In episode 43, we discussed this notion, and I'll bring this as a refresher of what I said. In that episode, I was discussing a research paper and explaining that P-cumaric acid played a role in detoxification capabilities of honeybees. And that's what they were actually looking at when they made this discovery. I'm going to play the rewind music sound of harps. Here's what I had to say in episode 43 as a refresher. In reading the paper, one part of the study seemed a little off point. The study indicates that these constituents are not found in nectar, but pollen and propolis. It is odd that they make this correlation about honey when they are pointing out specifically that pollen and propolis contain P. cumaric acid, which upregulates, quote, all classes of detoxification genes as well as peptide genes, end quote. That was a recap from 43. So back to this serendipitous discovery. They were apparently doing research along these lines when they recognized that bees reared only on royal jelly for 3 days did not demonstrate the gene expressions required to make a queen. So I'm going to read something to you that might make your head hurt. Bear with me. I'll explain this when I'm done. But first I have to give you two primers. Number one, epidermal growth factor receptor, or EGFR. This receptor determines cell proliferation and, in summary, contributes to the metabolism and growth. Number two, JHA methyltransferase. Juvenile hormone, JH, acid methyltransferase, is an enzyme that converts juvenile hormone acids, or inactive precursors of juvenile hormones, to active juvenile hormones at the final step of juvenile hormone biosynthesis pathway in insects. Another way to say this is juvenile hormones are a group of any one class of unsaturated hydrocarbons, such as carotenes, that are found in the essential oils of many plants. Okay, how'd you read that to read you this? This will make sense in a moment. Here's the research that I snipped and promised to read. In bee larvae, nutrition modulates juvenile hormone number 3, JHI3, and 20 ectosone titers via IIS/TOR and EGFR pathways to control caste differentiation. The fact that EGFR pathway is responsible for 20 ectosone synthesis suggests that its activation decreases development for time for queen-destined larvae, whereas AMILP1 regulates JH3 production via IIS-TOR to prevent autophagic programmed cell death in the ovary, thus increasing ovary size. 9 receptors, S6K, IRS, FOX, and the JHA methyltransferase genes related to the two pathways, and 20 EHJ3 synthesis were upregulated by P. cumaric acid, a pattern of expression identical to that found in queen-destined larvae. P. cumaric acid appears to influence developmental fate of female honeybee larvae via directly regulating expression of genes in caste determination pathways. Wow. So what did all that mean? In a nutshell, all of those components influence development in larvae and discern if it's a queen or not. It's that simple. For the honeybee, consuming biologically active phytochemicals may influence reproductive development in worker-destined larvae. They go on further to say, and I'm paraphrasing this, that the impact on the development of genes expressed in the influence of the fate of the larvae have so many dependencies on P. cumaric acid that they can assume that consumption of active phytochemicals may influence reproductive development in worker-destined larvae. So net-net, all of that meant, in other words, that it takes more than royal jelly to turn the genes on that determine the outcome. There you go. It's not just royal jelly that makes a queen. So the name of this research article is, A Dietary Phytochemical Alters Caste Association Gene Expression in Honeybees. The researchers are, and hopefully I'll pronounce these names correctly, Wenfu Mao, Mary Schuler, and May Barenbaum. It can be found in the Science Advances Journal, number 28, August 2015, Volume 1, Number 7. You don't have to remember all that. As you would expect, I'll provide a link to this in the show notes. Before I close, I want to say thanks to the listeners that forwarded this to me, Bob Kloss being one of them. I had it in the queue for recording, but still appreciate the listeners tipping me off to these things, as you are far more adept at digging things up than I can be alone. Segment number 3, this one's called Deadly Mimics. I brought up the topic of discovery that Varroa mimic honeybees in the episode before last, and I still think I might have covered it somewhere, but now, thinking back, it was probably related to small hive beetles and not Varroa mites. Oh, a little sidebar here. In that hive that I put together, the observation hive that I mentioned in the local hive report, I have hive beetles in there. I have about 8 to 10 of them that I've counted so far. They were in the mix of the bees. Who says that winter eliminates them? They overwinter with the bees. Now I have to figure out how to get them out of there, or else they slime the whole thing. Okay, back on topic. So the Varroa mimic story was something that I mentioned was shared to us by listener Arnold Nelson, and since I cannot find a record of talking about it in my notes, let's give it its due. The catalyst was sourced from Arnold from the National Wildlife Federation magazine, the October-November edition. The article ties back to research released in June of this year from Michigan State University that reveals the mites were able to emit a combination of chemicals that helped them smell more similar to their hosts. For the study, they moved mites hosted in hive with European honeybees, also known as Apis mellifera, to a hive with Asian honeybees, they're known as Apis cerane, and then vice versa. They use chemical detection to track the mite mimicking behavior. That's a cool approach. They take beetles out of a European hive, they put it in a cerane hive, and then they measure the odors coming off. And they take beetles out of a cerane hive and put them in a European hive and measure the odors coming off. And notice that they changed based on which host colony they were with. They made these exchange of mites, and after a few days, they pulled them out and used chemical detection called spectrometry to identify the extracts given off and were able to detect the mimicry. Now, if you think about it, to the benefit of the mite, there are a number of reasons this would be to their advantage. The first being, of course, they can penetrate the hive. They smell like a bee, so they can get in and not be judged. Second, but less thought of solution, would be that the bees can sometimes detect the odor of a foreign object in the hive. And in this case, the mite smells like a bee, it would get passed over while they're running around inside the hive. So this would be a means, for example, of thwarting a Varroa-sensitive hygiene bee. So it calls out in the study itself that the discovery in this study is contrary to previous research that suggested mites are not actively mimicking their host, but instead passively using host materials by coming into contact with the bees. So thinking about that practically, they're rubbing up against the bees or doing something with the bees that makes them smell like a bee. But they're saying in this study they've proved to the contrary. It appears from the abstract that it was known that mites could mimic a bee, but what was newly discovered is that they could do it on demand for either the Asian or the European hosts. This could explain the ease in which the Varroa jumped from bee species to bee species, and it's stated to be a good example of, quote-unquote, an arms race between parasite and host in the course of evolution. All fascinating stuff. Now I wonder if they could use this like a line in the pan, if you remember that reference. The research paper is entitled Varroa Destructor Changes Its Cuticular Hydrocarbons to Mimic New Hosts. It is published by the journal Biology Letters on June 3rd, 2015. And yeah, you know the drill. There's a link to the research paper in our notes. So So to close this out, just one more thanks to Arnold for sending that along. Interesting stuff. I should say or share a little commentary with you. Right in the middle of recording that, I got a little pop-up. Gary from Kiwi Mana popped over a message to say hello and chat with me. I'll have to catch up with him later, but I begged off so I could keep recording on your behalf. Haven't chatted with him in a while. Wonder what he's up to, and it's got to be spring there, so that should be an interesting interesting time for him. He's going to get really crazy busy, as I know. Anyway, now we head into the roundtable section. No more dings between segments. Roundtable number one, the conversion of honey to nectar. The bees do it. In episode 12, I spoke of the way to invert sugars from nectar to make honey. I described how the bees take in the nectar and conversion process starts with enzymes from their honey stomach or crop, as it's known as. They pass it along and it goes through the chemical conversion that breaks it down. Sucrose to glucose and fructose, among other things, and the byproduct of this process is gluconic acid, something that makes honey inhospitable to microbes, and it's why it doesn't spoil. I recently saw a chart on Facebook, somebody posted, that takes me back to the Miss Apis mellifera website, one that I've mentioned before on the podcast, episode 65 to be exact. I wanted to shout this out again, as it has a number of informative infographics that simplify some complex topics of honeybees, and you might find them useful in education settings, working with schools and such, and sometimes you might even print them, with their permission, of course, to do some public relations, if that's your kind of thing. So we'll provide links to the nectar, honey, pollen, and water infographic. It's at Miss Apis mellifera blog, and then we'll also give you a link to their homepage. Check those out. The website, as you might guess, is missapismellifera.com. Roundtable number two, this one's called Swinty Varroa Counter. In our last episode, I mentioned that we recently did a video with state apiarist Tim Schuler on performing an alcohol wash for counting mite ratios in a colony. Recently, I came across a video on YouTube from the Swinty Company, which sells beekeeping equipment out of Denmark. The video shows a procedure of a beekeeper anesthetizing, sorry, I can't say that word, and I'm going to slaughter it like 10 times in this segment. A sampling of bees, then shaking them in a contraption that allows you to shake off the mites and determine the mite count. The device appears to be powered by one of those small CO2 cartridges that you would use to insert and make whipped cream from. You know, when I was a kid, these CO2 cartridges, I used to find them along the railroad tracks and, you know, in the woods and things like that. Never knew what they were for. And then somewhere along the line, I came to know that people used to use them for something commonly referred to as a whippet. It was some form of inhalation that got you high. And I always thought these CO2 cartridges would be hard to come by. Because of that case, they didn't want kids to have them. Now, I have no personal experience other than the folklore of kids in high school talking about these things. And I'm assuming you can get them somewhere and they would sell it to us, an adult. But who knows? So anyway, back to this device. It appears you could purchase this from the company. And they come with CO2 or you could supply your own. And being anesthetized, see, I told you I can't say that word. The mites would fall off the bees when you shake them for 10 seconds. And after a period of time, the bees will wake up and you can return them to the hive. So while talking about this beekeeper supplier website, like propolis, etc., the website and catalog mentioned in our last episode, I always find it interesting to see what's for sale in other countries. It might be commonplace that this is how they do mite monitoring over there. It's a foreign concept to us here in the United States. So to that end, on the Swenty.com website, spelled S-W-I-E-N-T-Y.com, you could peruse items they have for sale. In the Varroa Control / Diseases section, they seem to sell dosing syringes, foggers, formic acid vaporizers, Varroa control cages, and other various contraptions that I've never seen. And it is in that section that you'll see the device I opened with. It's referred to simply as a Varroa tester. It says the kit will come with two 16-gram CO2 cartridges that will allow you to perform around 12 tests. The cost based on conversion is around $45 US, not including shipping. Their shopping cart appears to let you ship internationally, but I didn't buy one, so your mileage may vary. Interesting idea and option, especially for those that do not care to kill bees in any form or fashion. One other note on Swenty. This is that area where the type A, type B comes from that was mentioned in the last episode with Bob Kloss. So it's ironic that it turns up in this episode with this mite tester. I'll provide a link to the beekeeping equipment and also the YouTube that explains how it's used. By the way, it should note that there's no sound on that video. There's subtitles in a foreign language, and then the subtitles are rerun again in English, so you can follow along what's going on and understand what he's doing when he's doing the mite test. Roundtable number three, this one is Flowhive 1939 style. This was another Facebook find. I came across a Facebook post that had a link to a patented hive system from 1939. The owner of the patent, J.B. Garriga from Igualada, Barcelona, Spain, had these diagrams that depicted in principle a situation, a hive design that works so much like the way the flow hive opens the capsules of the honey cells and allows the honey to flow into a container below, which leads to a tube for collection. So tell me if this sounds familiar. From the patent application, it said, quote, "By the use of beehive cells, according to my invention, all of the operations of extracting honey from the hives are greatly simplified by dispensing with manipulations in the interior of the hive, with the result that the work of collecting honey, which is long, fatiguing, and even dangerous, is converted into short and easy operation, which can be performed by any person," end quote. And even lower in the patent filing, it goes on to say, quote, "The principal feature of the invention resides in the fact that the cells are composed of three parts, two of them being lateral parts, and the third central part, hereinafter referred to as the matrix wall. The matrix wall is adapted for certain extent of movement relatively to the lateral or side parts, whereby the matrix wall is enabled to take up a suitable position whereby the honey produced and contained in the cells can drain toward the outside and pass to receptacles, which can be conveniently removed by the beekeeper," end quote. So you have to see the diagram. If you look at the principle of the design and illustrations on page 2 and 3 of the application, you could draw the resemblance and DNA to how the flow hive works. My guess is, in principle, they are two different engineering approach to the same principle of extracting honey through some sort of mechanical means. The only difference is that we're 75 plus years advanced and have different materials and material knowledge at our disposal. I wonder what prevented John Biscaro Garriga from developing a patent commercially. Who knows, perhaps we'll all be using the Garriga hive instead of the Langstroth hive these days if it was a viable opportunity that the guy had in front of him. If only he had Indiegogo or some form of sponsorship like we do these days. Yep, check the show notes. We'll provide a link to the patent. Roundtable number four, Gardner Apiary's video. On the October 31st meeting, I mentioned that we shot a video of Mike Gardner talking about how their operation produces packages and produces queens. I think he spoke something like an hour long, and it was an outstanding session, one that even if you're a seasoned beekeeper, it would be interesting to watch. As a beekeeper new or a beekeeper seasoned, you will either be interested in buying packages someday or telling people how to buy packages someday. And watching this gives you a really good sense of what goes into it. And you could see the passion in his operation. The more interesting side, and I mentioned this when we talked about the recap of that meeting, is the questions that were asked from the audience. And if you listen hard enough, you'll recognize yours truly asking a couple of those. I was really excited about this session when it was coming, and I made a point to write down all of the questions that people asked from the audience, and I put them up in a text format along with the video, and then you get to hear his response to them. It is your duty in life to go watch that video, not because I need hits on that, but it's such a good topic to watch and understand. And learn how to do it. And learn how they do it. And understand the work and commitment that goes in. I have to say I learned a bunch of stuff from the video. And then I got to watch it again and again as I produced the video. And it made it even more informative. So don't be shy about watching it more than once. You'll pick something up each time you do the run through. So check that out. It's the feature video right now on our YouTube channel. As of this recording, that'll change, of course, in the future if you're listening to this some other time. But youtube.com/NWNJBA is the link. Look for Gardner Apiary's video. Roundtable number 5. This one's called Save the Corners. It's a short but simple trick. It's a simple concept, but interesting to me because of my recent experiences. I would say this year, more than most years in the past, I left my hives be. And one thing I noticed that they are really sealed when I go to open them up. I've had to exert a lot of force to get the hive tool in between the boxes because they are so glued together. And I more than ever had to mar the corners of the woodenware doing so. So recently I saw in a forum an idea that might help this situation and give the beekeeper a little purchase. Simply take a penny and put it on the corner where you typically enter the hive. It provides the smallest gap for you to get your hive tool in and not damage the woodenware. And I would assume, if you're thinking about we're making an artificial gap, that the gap left is negligible for the bees. And I would, again, assume that they could seal it up from the inside and not cause a problem to ventilation and such. If you're really that concerned, you could probably run some painter's tape around that corner where the gap is. So I'm looking forward to trying this in the spring and seeing how it works. Smart and simple and worth a try. Roundtable number 7, this one's called Broodminder. I know this is typically done via video, and I'm going to do it through audio, but I'll do my best to describe it. I hold in my hand a Broodminder box shipped from Staunton, Wisconsin. After the last episode where Bob Kloss and I previewed this, we both went and bought one of these through the Indiegogo campaign, and they were successful, and I received mine literally today. So I'm sitting here cutting the tape on it, and I'm going to open the box. It's a flat package, about 8 by 10. And as I unfold it, I have a Broodminder. Let me see if I could describe what this looks like. So inside the box, there's a single piece of paper, like an oak tag. It's printed with attractive graphics. It says Broodminder on it with a hexacomb and heartbeat-style symbol. It says, congratulations on your new Broodminder instructions. Download the Broodminder app from the Apple App Store, Android Play Store. 2, pull to remove the battery tab. 3, write hive name on the Broodminder flap or peel backing from unique battery tab label to use as a hive identifier. 4, place device on frame 5 or 6 in your uppermost brood box with the Broodminder flap sticking out of the hive. And 5, start app. It should automatically start reading hive data. Go to broodminder.com for more tips. And written in hand, it says, thanks, Rich. And I have the device. It is about 8 inches long, about 1.5 inches wide. It's white, clear, with a imprinted hexagon logo. It says Broodminder in black, brood white minder on it. You can see through the bottom edge, looks like a clear panel that you could see the electronics. And I see the pull tab that I just read about. And there's a little flappy thing. It's like a plastic edge that hangs out, and it has hive with a little indicator on it that you can write the name. My guess is if you buy a whole bunch of these things, then you would write the hive name on it. And as you come through and sample each one of the hives, it would give you an indication of which one you're working with. The device itself feels like it's made from that plastic that you would get that wraps a product that you buy from the store that you can never get open. It's that hard, stiff plastic. It's a tapered device. The end with the sensor has a square flat end, and it tapers down to an almost flat point, if not a flat point, like a wedge-shaped along the 8 inches. Underneath, I feel something that feels like a sticky, almost like a half of a bubble gum, but you know, that type of sticky that must be used to keep it in place. And there's another one on the tab that sticks out. So you could look at the videos from the Broodminder website to see how they place them in the hive. It's not overly complicated, folks. You just lay it in there with this tab sticking out through the opening slit. And it's thin enough, of course, that it should not move around in there. So the next logical question is, how much do they cost and where can you get one? If you got in on the Indiegogo campaign, they cost $45 a piece. If you go there now, it's $60 plus shipping. Given the campaign is over, I'm happy to say that they raised $27,294 and they were funded 117% of their original. And I have to applaud Rich, the owner, on his communication campaign. It was outstanding. We were getting updates all the way along, and you could just sense the excitement from his team about making these things. There were pictures of the parts that came in. There were pictures of them assembling. There were pictures of them boxing them. And then there was a personal notice from them saying that they were being shipped. I think it was extremely well handled, and happy to have supported and be a part of it. So if you're interested in looking at these and you want to make a purchase, they're going to sell them still through the Indiegogo campaign. You can go to broodminder.com and there's links on the homepage that explain more of the information, show you pictures of it, and you can go and find where to click to buy one. So check that out, broodminder.com, and congratulations to them for their launch. I'm looking forward to putting one of these in the hive. I'm not sure yet, haven't decided whether we're going to put this in now or wait till spring. It depends on whether I have any manipulations to do. Given the bees have sealed the hive for winter, I don't know that I want to open it up. However, they're talking about this weekend potentially being 60, 65 degrees, which could break records here in New Jersey. So, yeah, maybe there is an opportunity to check this out. That would be cool to start getting some readings on these. All right, there you go. Broodminder unboxing. A lot of fun doing that. Roundtable number 7, listener mail. First one comes from David Weldon. David wrote in to say thanks for the time and energy expended on creating the podcast. He's Canadian, but keeps his bees on the Point Roberts, Washington side of the house. He wanted us to know that the summers in that corner of the world are pleasant, making observation to my trip to Seattle, and that the wet aspect of the Pacific region are more about the winters. Given what I've seen over the last weather reports of the recent times, it seems, David, you're spot on, as all of Victoria, the entire western side of Washington and Oregon are covered in green on the radar and have their abundance of rain lately. I think I'll stick to summers if I come out that way again, and thanks for writing in. Bob Brownsdorf wrote in to follow up on the topic with Bob Kloss about bonding coroplast plastic signs. He shared that Harbor Freight sells plastic welders that you can use to bond the substrates. That's so cool, and I'm thinking of going all MacGyver or something on these things. I saw a video of a guy on YouTube using what looked like something akin to a branding iron prior to doing that segment and said, I don't know about that. That guy pressed it on a few sheets and melted them together, but he had some big elaborate rig that looked out of touch for the normal layperson in their garage. And I wondered if you could do this with something like a soldering iron, and now Bob has provided me with an option to research. Yes, I'm still smitten with this crazy idea of building colony boxes with the political signs that I have. He personally said he used it successfully on a kayak repair after a scouting trip. I bet there's a story behind that. Bob Kloss will tell you that I love bonding PVC pipes together for different things. To me, they're a bit like Lincoln Logs or erector sets. But there comes a time when you might want to do some electric repair or bond things together, and there's no feasible way to do it. I meant plastic repair, not electric repair. I don't know what my brain was thinking. I have seen the light. The one that I looked at on the Harbor Freight website will output temps from 105 degrees to 850 degrees Fahrenheit. And I can think of other things that you might consider using this for. The cost for a 1,300-watt device is about $65, and that's not too out of line. Santa, can you hear me? Thanks, Bob, for the tip. By the way, he's from Seekonk, Mass. Kevin Moment, if memory serves me right, there's a racetrack there. Sharon and the boys will tell you that I have racetrack mileposts all over the United States everywhere we go. We drive along the interstate and I'll see a sign and say to no one in particular, Seekonk, there's a racetrack there. It's in the blood, I think. Todd Mastick, he wrote in to comment about the NWNJ mentoring hives. He's lost two hives to the same fate this year, yellow jackets. In follow-up to that, we did confirm that it was yellow jackets that killed our three hives. Apparently, I must have been living under a rock because it's more common than I imagined. Although, again, I'll reiterate, every beekeeping person I ever talked to, nobody ever heard of this. But if you look it up on a website, and Bob Kloss did that, he found a number of resources verifying the concept and that there have been a handful of people since that episode, indicating to us that their hives have also been taken over by yellow jackets and or wasps. You know, it's so frustrating every year to learn about or physically encounter something that disrupts your operations. Like, what's next? Locusts or something? Yeah, we keep soldiering on. Todd Mastick sent that along. He commented he's from Warrington, PA. That's pretty close to us. No more than a 30-minute, 40 run out Route 202. Maybe Todd will cross paths someday, and if we haven't, be sure to say hello and thanks for writing in. That's it for listener mail. Let's go to roundtable number 8. Roundtable number 8, recap on tap. two little subsegments here. First one is I wanted to recap our last meeting, our closing meeting for the Northwest New Jersey Beekeepers Association. It struck me when talking about our year to the audience, I'm so impressed at all that we accomplished this year as my first year as president, and I have a newfound respect for what Bob Kloss, Charlie Ilsley, Scott Horsnell, and all the presidents that came before. You stand up there and you pontificate about the things that you do and all the appreciation for all that take part. And as the president, you get a lot of kudos for these things, but it really is the network of people, the colony, as I mentioned, that get all this work done. And I'm so fortunate to have a great crew. This year, we honored Karen Weinberg, who was a longtime officer in the club. In fact, when I joined the club, she was the treasurer, and she was also instrumental in running the Warren County Fair, and we gave her a gift of appreciation. And the thing that I like about Karen is the fact that now she sits in the audience and she doesn't have responsibilities to the association, and she could be a member again. And when I'm giving talks or listening, whatever, in the audience, sitting alongside of her, I hear her engagement. And they're often usually very insightful. And she'll say things, she's pretty outspoken, that people are thinking, but she's willing to ask the question or make the comment based on what's being presented. She's an active crowd and participant, as we joke about. That's a little side joke inside the family. I won't go there. But the fact of the matter is, I do really appreciate the work that someone has put in. And for Karen, it has been lifelong. I don't know how long literally she's been a member, but it goes back to the Jake Mathenius days. And while she's still actively taking care of her family, taking care of her career, taking care of her bees and everything else that goes on in life, she is an active participant in her life, let alone our club. And she still looks after Jake Mathenius, who's up in age, and takes care of him and is a bit of a custodian for him. So kudos to Karen for her pursuit in those efforts. Also, the Spirit Award this year went to Charlie Ilsley, who I've haven't on the podcast and mentioned on occasion. Charlie is an indomitable spirit, and the Spirit Award so suits him. We talked over the year about our accomplishments in the club and many of the things. He also volunteered this year to be the treasurer at the state level and is actively participating there. He's doing all his research, and at EAS, they're going to do a talk about his grow degree days and his strategies for pyramiding up and checkerboarding and all the things that he's been working on with the data from the New Jersey Swarm Report. And I don't know anybody, seriously, I don't think I know anybody, maybe Tim Schuller, but probably more Charlie Ilsley, that lives, breathes, and drinks beekeeping. And God bless him for that. He calls sometimes with the craziest things. He calls, well, my phone rings 2-3 times a week sometimes with Charlie, but it's always a fascinating conversation, I can assure you of that. That being said, we also honored George Schaefer and George Schaefer Jr. for their contributions to beekeeping. Unfortunately, they couldn't participate, but we'll be giving them some awards when we see them next. And, you know, bee lining, the spring meeting with Dave Tarpey and other accomplishments this year. I'd say it's been a good year for Northwest New Jersey, and looking forward to even more. So that brings me to the second thing. That's the recap. What's on tap is the spring meeting. We're going to do it again. Our executive board decided that we once again will host the spring meeting for the NJBA. We had such a good experience this year, and the fact of the matter is we're looking to run the same game plan, so to speak. Different speaker, but probably the same location. It was central and we had good participation from all over. I have a few other topics that we would cover to mix it up so we don't do the same boring thing again. And we've got the registration and catering aspect down pat, so why not do it again? And the crew is energized and really had a good experience. So that tells you how good of a year and experience it was if they're willing to just volunteer to do it again. That's pretty cool. I haven't told Janet Katz, the president. I think it might have been hinted to her, but I'll go back and confirm that. And I'm sure she'll be really pleased that Northwest is willing to help the state out run one of their four meetings. The last one was run by the exec board of NJBA. And for any of you listening, first, go join your association. And two, become a part of the solution. Help at the state level, help at the local level, and volunteer. It really is the greatest thing for beekeeping, to help others. So there you go. Recap on tap. That's roundtable number 8. So I've made my way to the bottom of the pile. I do want to recognize today, December 7th, a day that will live in infamy. It strikes me that I recorded an episode called Lest We Forget last year on this date, and here we are again. It's an odd day for me, recording on a Monday. I'd hoped to do this yesterday, but overtaken by events. So we do remember those days. 74 years ago, I think I have the number right. If not, forgive me. But great sacrifice for our country and a turning point in our history. We take a moment to pause and thank all the veterans, those who sacrificed. I recognize with my business trip and other things going on, I'm off my cadence here. I'd hope to do something every 2 weeks to that end. This weekend, I am planning to release a bonus episode. I wanted to release the talk that Carly Toth gave. I'll put a short bumper in front and behind it and put that out this weekend, and you'll get caught up on our episode cadence. So that's it for this episode. I see I've crossed the hour mark, so let's close it down. I'll leave you with this. Like our beloved bees, when beekeepers go together, we accomplish great things. Thanks for listening, everyone. And be well.